Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dar Jamail. He's an award-winning journalist and author who's a full-time staff reporter for Truthout.org. His work is currently focusing on anthropogenic climate disruption. So first, as always, thank you for your tremendous work. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks very much for having me, Derek. Always a pleasure to be with you.
So I've heard through your reporting that something terrible is happening off the coast of Alaska. Can you tell me about that?
The Navy is poised to begin what they call Northern Edge, which is a huge joint exercise they're doing actually in conjunction with the Air Force, Marines, and Army up in Alaska. But the Navy's aspect is going to focus in a huge area. It's actually over 8,000 square nautical miles, excuse me, off the coast of Alaska, basically between Cordova and Kodiak. There's a giant rectangle-shaped area which they've been permitted to use to conduct active and passive sonar weapons testing and live fire exercises, including bombs, missiles, bullets, and torpedoes, starting actually 5 days from when we are doing this interview, starting on June 15 and going for at least 2 weeks. And then they're permitted to continue doing this year after year up until 2020 is what they're pushing for. And actually plans are in the works for them to request permits up through 2030. And so what's really troubling about this, aside from the obviousness of it, is the fact that the area in question, it's critical habitat for all five Alaska salmon species, as well as almost a dozen different whale species, including the highly endangered North Pacific right whale, of which there are only about 30 left in total, along with dolphins and sea lions and hundreds of other marine species and marine mammals in the area. Not even to speak about the dozen native tribes living along coastal Alaska that are going to be directly impacted by their subsistence living being destroyed and damaged and poisoned. And some of these tribes include the Eskimo, the Eyak, the Athabascans, Tlingits, and the Shunak and the Aleut tribes, just to name a few. So that's what's coming, and it's extremely troubling because there actually have been and continue to be uprisings in the communities in coastal Alaska against this. For example, the cities of both Cordova and Kodiak have passed resolutions opposing the Navy's plans, but the Navy have basically thumbed their noses at these voices of protest and are loading up their bombs.
So tell me explicitly what is wrong with having what you talk about the creatures who live there, but how is this going to harm them?
Well, the Navy is permitted to release as much as 352,000 pounds of what they call expended materials every year. That includes the live munitions that I mentioned, missiles, bombs, torpedoes, et cetera, but also other types of things that will be released into the marine environment. And so just by way of example, one of the propellants in one of the missiles and torpedoes that they want to use contains cyanide. And so the EPA, by way of example, they have a quote-unquote allowable limit of cyanide, which is one part per billion. And the type of cyanide in the Navy torpedo is going to be introducing cyanide into the waters of Alaska in the range of 140 to 150 parts per billion. So compare that to the so-called one part per billion of allowable cyanide, according to the EPA. Also, other impacts are going to include what are called takes, which is basically a military bureaucratic way of covering over a death. The Navy's own environmental impact statement estimates that over the five-year period that their war games are going to be conducted, there will be over 182,000 takes, which is a direct death of a marine mammal or the secondary disruption of essential behaviors of that mammal, things like breeding, nursing, or surfacing, which cause death. also. So there's two ways they'll be killing marine mammals. It will be either direct impact of them literally being exploded by bombs or shot by bullets or internally hemorrhaged and killed by massive sonar, or secondarily, you know, essential behaviors like surfacing or having babies or things like that will be caused to not be able to happen. So that's a few of the examples, not even to talk about over a dozen large ships roaming around in the area, preventing fisher folks from using the area. So it means natives relying on that area for subsistence fishing and living will be unable to carry that out as well.
So you mentioned two of the ways they'd be killed, whether they'd be shot directly or whether they would be have their behavior influenced. But you've also actually mentioned another one, which is poison through cyanide or other means. And then you also mentioned earlier sonar. So will this be particularly worse on the sonar than normal, or will this just be the standard problems with sonar? And then can you mention briefly some of the problems with sonar in case people don't know about them?
It's not your average sonar that like a transport vessel or a fisher person might use to track the depth of the water or to navigate with. It's not like that at all. We're talking about weapons grade sonar. In fact, the Navy, even down here where I live, down here compared to Alaska in Washington State, regularly conducts underwater sonar weapons testing. So literally they are developing different types of sonar that they have weaponized to use in order to knock out communications and electronics, and I think they're aiming towards knocking out life in other Navy vessels from other countries. So this is a type of sonar, like, for example, and we've already actually seen the NRDC won a lawsuit against the Navy down off Southern California, where they showed the Navy was deliberately using sonar in an area knowingly impacting over 9 million a different marine biota, you know, fish, whales, et cetera, deleteriously by the use of this sonar. So there's also well-documented cases around the globe of pods of whales, dolphins, et cetera, that get hit by this sonar. And then you see these huge amounts of these mammals washing up on the shore. A lot of the time you'll see their eardrums are exploded and it causes internal hemorrhaging. So there's actually been cases of dolphins washing up literally with blood coming out of their heads because they've happened to been in an area when the Navy's been using this type of weapons grade sonar.
So do you happen to know, there's something, if you happen to know this or can make a quick guess at it, what the decibel levels of the sonar is on those? Because if we do know, then I have something I wrote for Endgame about what that actually converts to in terms of a way, in terms of actual sound for us. Do you happen to have any idea?
I don't, other than to just reiterate that it's powerful enough to literally explode the eardrums of whales and dolphins, and this has been very well documented. So, you know, and of course, these are mammals that, you know, that is how they communicate. This is how they navigate. It is obviously without that ability or having it compromised in any way, basically means these mammals are going to die. And when you're using it at a level that literally is exploding their internal organs to the point where blood is coming out of their head, that gives you an idea of how powerful it is.
Okay, well, I'll go ahead and read this anyway, because then when people can, they can have something to match to whatever it ends up being. And the thing I was writing about earlier, this is like 2000, this is from Endgame, is that the National Science Foundation had a ship that was using air guns to fire sonic blasts of up to 260 dB to use for mapping the ocean floor. And 260 dB didn't mean anything to me, so I went through, damage to human hearing begins at 85 dB, a police siren at 30 meters is 100 dB, and decibels are logarithmic, meaning that for every 10 dB increase translates to 10 times more intensity, and sounds, because human perception is also logarithmic, twice as loud. So What that means is that the blast from those research vessels were 10 quadrillion times more intense than a siren at 30 meters and would sound to humans 16,384 times as loud. The sound of a jet taking off at 600 meters is 110 dB. A rock concert is 120 dB. And whales and other creatures are subject to sounds 100 trillion times more intense than that. The threshold at which humans die from sound is 160 dB. Anyway, so that's just that all. The whole thing of the sonic pollution of the oceans is something that scares me as much as almost anything else.
It is, and I'm glad that you bring that up and make all of those direct connections to give people an idea of what we're talking about, because we're talking about the military developing sound in a way as to use it as a weapon. And so as though the oceans aren't already suffering enough from plastic pollution, which I know you've written about and talked about for decades, of the extreme amount of plastic pollution now that's insidious around all the oceans on the planet, to acidification happening from rising temperatures, and now the military on top of that decides we're going to go basically bomb and use sound weapons as much as possible up in what are absolutely some of the most pristine waters on the planet outside of Antarctica. I mean, because bear in mind, these waters in Alaska are at the end of an undersea current that is an upwelling, and this water is 1,000 years old. So this is why Alaska salmon are so sought after and so prized, because they are clean fish, they're pure, and the Alaska salmon brand relies on it. And it's another reason not to commercialize this, but it is important to think about when, again, talking about the people in Alaska relying so heavily on the salmon for both subsistence and for a way to earn a living up there, and all of that is being compromised. And so that's creating an interesting phenomenon, whereas the Navy's actions are actually starting to cause some collaboration between people across a political spectrum that normally really wouldn't mix.
Well, let's talk about those alliances in a moment. But before then, let's talk about potential reasons for the military doing this, these exercises, apart from the fact that this culture has a death urge and is destroying the planet. We'll just take that for granted and leave it aside for now. What is the rationale for doing these exercises up there?
Yeah, and I mentioned this in the article too, that how the Navy is basically increasingly focused on possible future climate change wars up in the melting waters of the Arctic, and in that context just has no intention of caretaking the environment when it comes to conducting its military exercises. So, what's amazing to me is I was literally I was in Alaska getting the ground data for this story, doing interviews. I went to Cordova, I went over to Kodiak, I passed through Anchorage talking to people all along the way. And then I came back home to Washington State to write this story. And I live right on Puget Sound. I live right on the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And while I'm writing this story up about this impending naval exercise up in the Gulf of Alaska, the largest exercise of its kind in that area in the over 30 years the Navy's been doing these exercises up there. And while I'm writing this story up, literally about 2 miles from my house out on the Strait of Juan de Fuca, Shell is bringing their giant drilling rig over to the port of Seattle, where it's going to tie up. This is right during the lead up to the activism and all of the news that came out around that time of against Shell and their drilling plans up in the Chukchi Sea. And literally, as I'm writing this story about the naval war games, they're positioning these rigs up in Seattle, getting them ready to start bringing up to Alaska to start their drilling. So it doesn't take a genius to see the writing on the wall as to the timings of these. It's not a coincidence. The Navy is getting ready to protect so-called U.S. interests, to go up into the Arctic. They're racing Russia. They're racing other Western Scandinavian countries to do the same thing. Basically, anyone that has any kind of a border with the Arctic, everyone is in full preparation to go up there for the race for what's left of to try to tap into this oil that's been under the ice up there, and it's been prohibitively so that people couldn't access it. But the Navy itself, and I wrote about this over a year ago, They conducted their own study, and they estimated that all of the Arctic ice would start to see ice-free periods in the summer in the Arctic starting by 2016 was their estimate. And if we look at the current satellite data, the mapping of the ice, both in extent and volume up in the Arctic, just a couple of weeks ago, it came out that in the entire satellite era, right now, the Arctic ice is at its lowest extent and volume on record. So it certainly does look like it's on a pace where it's not out of the realm of possibility now that by late summer 2016, meaning late August, early September, we'll probably start to see those ice-free periods. So that's the context in which all of this is happening. The military is getting ready. That's why there's this massive uptick in wargaming across the entire country, not just the Navy, but on land. The Air Force is doing things. The Marines are doing things. All of this massive wargaming because the military is positioning itself for future potential wars against Russia and China, but also the race for the Arctic resources is clearly very high on their agenda.
This is one of the things, I mean, one of the differences between a lot of my writing and a lot of the writing of other, a lot of environmentalists or nature writers or whatever, has been that it's really clear to me that there won't be a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. And what you're saying right now is just one of the best examples I can think of for this, that instead of being completely horrified that the Arctic could be ice-free and will be ice-free soon, that instead they are looking at it with what can only be deemed lust for the resources that will be made available. And I find it impossible to express through words the disgust, contempt, and hatred that makes me feel.
I agree and have had the same experience, Derek. I mean, one reason I wanted to do this article was I lived up in Anchorage for 10 years. That's where I was living when the Iraq War broke out. And my work as a journalist is what ultimately brought me out to move out of Alaska. But I love the state, meaning I love the nature there. And I loved going into the mountains and going out on boats with people into the waters and camping and climbing. And I just reveled in the powerful natural beauty of the state. And of course, that includes the oceans and the wildlife and the marine mammals. And when I learned of the Navy's plans and I wanted to go up there and report on it, kind of out of a protective urge for this place that is so close to my heart. And when I was up there working on the story and talking to all these people that were going to be impacted by these Navy exercises, I felt that same kind of anger as well. First, it was just almost a mystification that not only are we going off the cliff as a planet, as a species, because of the industrial growth society and what it's done to the planet and what it's doing and continues to do, but we're accelerating. And, you know, it's the planet is showing us every distress signal it possibly can. We're literally watching huge parts of the ecosystem die, increasingly vast numbers of species going extinct, even more and more public awareness of the possibility of our own species rendering itself extinct. And instead of taking a more precautionary approach, slowing down, pausing to think just a minute about maybe what we're doing isn't the best thing, it's not even full steam ahead. It's let's accelerate as fast as possible into this dark, basically death-giving future of we're going to war game, we're going to drop more ordnance, we're going to get ready to go up into one of the most pristine areas left on the planet, pollute it like it's never been polluted before, all for the sake of drilling it, sucking out more oil that shouldn't even be burned in the first place, because it's only going to further accelerate what we're already doing to the planet. It really is. It's stupefying, and it's almost beyond imagination. It's something out of a really bad sci-fi novel, but unfortunately for us, it's the reality.
Yeah. So moving from that beautiful articulation that you just made of the reality we face, let's move back to the to what you mentioned earlier about some surprising alliances against these particular maneuvers.
Yeah, there have been many. I mean, case in point, the overall fishing community, the commercial fishing community in Alaska, you know, they're not exactly known for being lefty, greeny environmentalists. I mean, they're there to catch fish and make as much money as possible off of catching maximum amounts of fish as they're allowed by law every season, and then profiting from it. But when this news of the Navy's plan started to spread around the coastal Alaska, people from these very, very politically conservative fisher folk across two different fishermen's unions across the state started to band together. And everyone, literally everyone that I spoke with about the Navy exercise, every fisher person, every person in a fisherman's union across the state, et cetera, all of them were opposed to the Navy's plans. And, you know, when the Navy played the card of, well, this is for national security and we have to do this for protecting our state and our waters, et cetera, they basically all called BS on it and said, no, we're not buying that, you know? And so we had, you know, people from the Alaska Marine Conservation Council to the Alaskans First Coalition to fishermen's unions to everyone banding together and saying, look, not just environmental groups, but all these other groups, and saying, look, we're absolutely opposed to this. And so if there's it's really, really hard to find a silver lining to this story. But if there is one, that might be it, where we're starting to see this kind of coalescing of groups across the political spectrum kind of standing up together and seeing the madness perpetrated by the Industrial Growth Society and starting to stand up against it.
Are you seeing people up in Alaska who were independent of you, but on their own, making that connection to between these destructive activities and the Industrial Growth Society? And were they making that connection themselves, and or were they making the connections that you were making about we're accelerating over a cliff, and I mean we're going over a cliff and just accelerating? Were they making that, and were you hearing? I'm always kind of interested as to what you know. Most of the people I talk to fully recognize that, you know, civilization is inherently destructive, and it's always interesting to me to get in a conversation with somebody on a bus or, you know, just somebody who is not in my group and have them also remark, oh, yeah, I mean, everybody can recognize that this growth can't continue. So are you picking up on that up there, too? Do you see what I'm trying to ask?
No, I do. And not so much, unfortunately. I mean, there were exceptions. I mean, I think one of the most important voices in the story was that of a woman named Emily Stolarczyk, who is works for a group out of Cordova called the EAC Preservation Council, which is an environmental and social justice oriented nonprofit whose primary aim is to simply protect wild salmon habitat, period. You'd be very fond of these folks, Derek, given a lot of what you've written about regarding salmon and dams, and they do amazing work. But Emily, she is one person up there who absolutely sees the bigger picture, gets what's happening, exactly as you just described it, you know, and she's gone out of her way to basically sound the alarm bell on this. And of course has since then therefore been targeted by The government of Alaska, the Navy itself, you know, people are really coming after her now. But she has drawn these bigger connections and has talked about it. And I think that's part of why she's being targeted. But unfortunately, the average person that I spoke with tended to not really see beyond the immediate economic impact of this. And that was really, for a lot of folks, that was their primary motivation, is like, well, we can't lose the Alaska salmon brand. We can't have it come out where these are contaminated in any way, because if that market tanks, we're in big trouble. So they're looking at it from strictly an economic perspective. But, you know, Emily Stolarczyk, there were some folks I spoke with over in Kodiak who also got the bigger picture. But unfortunately, in general, it was not so often the case that I was speaking with people that really were connecting all the dots.
How is she being targeted, and how can listeners to this interview, I will ask later how they can help on the larger picture, but how can they help her?
Well, I think, first of all, she's been targeted by, for example, the Navy's come out and tried to discredit her, even though Emily has gone out of her way to quote directly from the Navy's own environmental impact statement. It's online. People can look it up themselves. And she literally is using quotes. She's been going around giving a presentation, a PowerPoint presentation to fishing communities around the state. And the Navy's come after her and said, look, you know, you're not giving accurate information. And she's saying, well, look, I'm quoting directly from your own Navy-generated environmental impact statement, and yet they continue to come after her and accuse her of causing trouble, of inflating figures, of misrepresenting facts, etc. And you know, given the military and how deified they are by mainstream America and by the corporate media, you know, as kind of this benevolent force that is only there to protect us, you know, which is absolute nonsense. But because of that misperception, you know, most people still tend to believe the military as though they're moral. And she's been targeted by then, of course, Senator Lisa Murkowski, hardcore right wing, anti-environment, pro corporate profit, pro fossil fuel industry, pro military senator up there in Alaska. And she basically sent her fisheries person, the state fisheries person, down to meet with Emily. And this is a person who went on to actually call her on her personal cell phone at night and cuss her out and threaten her, to the point where the person later emailed her an apology for it. So she's, you know, there's been bellicose threats, bellicose language used against her from this person, from in the Navy itself. The Navy's gone in and found anyone in these communities who could potentially be on their side and actively work to turn them against Emily Stolarczyk and the EAC Preservation Council, trying to demonize them, putting out false facts, trying to make it as though the EAC Preservation Council isn't actually working to preserve critical salmon habitat, which is their stated purpose. So basically negative propaganda campaigns run against her and the organization that she runs for. And what can people do to support her is, I think, other people need to take up the fight against the Navy and you know, get up on the facts of the story, understand what the Navy is planning on doing, and basically join in the fight and you know, not necessarily come to try to work directly alongside Emily Stolarczyk, but to understand the relevance of her work and the importance of it. And people even down here, because these types of Navy war games are happening off the coast of Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and certainly California, and have been for a long time. So anyone in proximity to those coasts, this is our fight too. And all of us need to be talking about this. All of us need to be getting this into the media and getting as many activists involved as possible, people that might have other ideas of how they might be able to help out.
So I want to come back to that in a minute, but there's another topic I want to hit for a second, which is, you mentioned Murkowski, who, you know, I have multi-generation hatred for her with, you know, Murkowski, her father was just as horrible. And so who are – and you and I both fully recognize the institutional and social natures of this, but who are some of the specific villains, too, who have been – Like we know that the removal of the Elwha Dam, Slade Gorton, the senator from Washington, made it his agenda to specifically delay that as long as he could. So who are some of the specific, and once again, I don't want to personalize this too much, but who are some of the specific villains of this? Who are some of the real proponents, some of the people who've gone out of their way to support and to promote these particular actions?
Well, I'll talk in Alaska, definitely Lisa Murkowski, Congressman Don Young up there. I'm sure you're
Oh, it's another of my favorites.
way too familiar with his name. Yeah, this guy is quite the piece of work. So those are the two primary sources up in Alaska that are always, no matter what, full steam ahead with anything the military and the fossil fuel industry wants. So those are two people that absolutely folks can count as villains in this story. They are actively working against the interests of nature and the planet in every possible conceivable way. But then, we go on down the state, and using my state just as a case study, Washington State, for example, we have Governor Jay Inslee, who paints himself as the Green Governor. And when I first moved here, I thought, yeah, this guy's doing a lot of good stuff. He's taking climate change issue on head on. He's saying a lot of the right things and sometimes doing some of the right things. But when you look at how deeply embedded the military is in this state and how much money the state gets from their presence here, and I'm sure the same can be said for California, this is a governor who knowingly accepts what the Navy is doing here, is not taking a stance directly against their war gaming that is already going on here, as well as future war game plans for the state of Washington, and is basically in their back pocket. And that would include Derek Kilmore, one of the representatives here, and numerous other political so-called representatives. And I'm sure the same can be said in California. And I think people who hear about this and think, oh, well, they're Democrats, so they wouldn't do this, or they proclaim themselves as being a little bit more left politically. That's irrelevant in this story with the military. The military is so embedded in these states, and there's so much money being brought into the states by their presence, that you'd be hard pressed to find a political so-called representative that is not on the take. And that gives you an idea of why there isn't any real political pushback against these exercises.
I don't know if you want to deal with this or where you might want to go with it. You can ignore it if you want, but there's a line that's always stuck with me that we all know that the military is a giant corporate welfare form and a giant form of Keynesian stimulus. And there's always the question, since capitalism relies on subsidies, why can't they just subsidize nice things instead of bad things? And back during the whole B-1 bomber fiasco back in the 70s, George McGovern asked somebody at, I think, Lockheed Martin or whatever company it was that was building them. He said, "Hey, so you just care about money, right? You don't actually care about building bombers, right?" And the guy said, "Yeah." He said, "So if I can get Congress to pass a law saying that we will give you money to build school buses instead of build B-1 bombers, will you do it?" This is George McGovern, famous liberal. And the guy said, "Sure, we'd do it." And then they both just burst out laughing because the whole notion was so absurd because they knew it could never happen. I mean, is there anything you want to do with that?
Well, I mean, it's true. I mean, it's the at this point in with the U.S. military, I would just add on to that, that at this point with the United States being in the final stage of empire, meaning, when we look through history, there's numerous ways empires use to maintain control and power. And the last, there's the economy, there's propaganda, there's actually trying to appeal to people's morality, etc. And the final stage, and the weakest and the shortest, is using military might. And this is why when we saw, like with Rome, for example, the final stage was they had pushed the military frontiers out as far as possible and put all their resources into maintaining and growing the military. And then it collapsed relatively shortly thereafter. And that's exactly what the U.S. is doing. You know, we're talking about, you know, today while we do this interview, we have news of them setting up yet another new U.S. base in Iraq and sending more troops over there. There's, you know, these domestic military exercises that are pushing new bounds of what's ever even been done before, looking at expanding up into the Arctic, preparation for wargaming against Russia and China in the future. I mean, that's exactly what the military is doing and being used to do now. You know, it's over 50% of all U.S. taxpayer money goes directly to the Pentagon in one way or another. And so how are we not already doing that? And I think it's just important to keep in mind that, I think that just kind of underscores what you just said, Derek, where, you know, the idea, the preposterous idea that something could be done differently, I don't think anyone could really take it seriously at this stage of the game, because everyone understands what's happening with the military, that it's really kind of the final weapon that the U.S. government is using geopolitically at this point. And I think anyone that's going to really question that or challenge that and really think they're going to change that at this stage of the game is just literally not living in reality.
Yeah. You know, this reminds me of something else, too. I don't know. Did you know that when I was raised a Seventh-day Adventist, and we were basically the Adventists are Christian fundamentalists, and I remember when I was 15, I wrote this essay for the bicentennial about how the United States had failed our brave allies in Vietnam. You know, I was this complete little right-wing fascist who thought we should nuke the commies. But a couple things, many things got me out of that. Obviously, I've moved a little bit since then. But a few things got me out of that. One of them is I read this one book called The People's Almanac, and in there they had this line about, or this section about the $1 trillion rat hole. And they were talking about how much money went to the military. And it was just this very simple thing about, okay, basically, if you took all the money that had been spent on, I don't know, the Vietnam War, what is it? It's 40 years ago. I don't remember. You know, if you took all the money that was spent on the military, you could build basically a hospital in every city or in every town of more than 400 people. You could pay for everybody's college education. It was just, you know, all the things that we've seen elsewhere. But this was the first time I really saw it. And I remember also seeing this figure that it cost about $500,000 for every person in Vietnam that the United States military killed. And it just struck me as, yes, it's just horrifying and completely outrageous and a complete atrocity that the United States invaded this country and killed millions of people. But in addition, this is a country where the per capita income at the time was like $100 a year, and they were spending $500,000 each to kill them. I mean, they would have been much better off just giving them each one $20,000 and saying, hey, like the United States. And I read something similar, and you might know the numbers on this. I read something similar about the amount of military subsidy for every barrel of oil that came out of the Near East, and it's like $200 or $500 or something dollars per barrel. Do you know the numbers on this?
No, I haven't heard that.
Yeah, but you know generally what I'm trying to say, right?
Right.
It just ends up being economically this incredibly stupid decision. That's actually where this is going. Is do you also know the numbers on how much this is going to cost, as well as the environmental degradation?
No, the military is very careful not to release total figures of these types of exercises. But I mean, I know from one study I saw about, you know, I think we've talked a little bit in the past about the electromagnetic warfare training that the Navy is trying to push through and start conducting out on the Olympic Peninsula starting early next year. And they want to use these Growler jet aircraft, these F-18. They're called Growlers. They're maybe because they're the loudest aircraft ever built in the world. Extremely loud, ear-splittingly loud. And yet to fly one of those costs over $12,000 an hour. Just to fly a jet. And you're not talking about what it costs to operate a warship. So it's difficult to come by these figures, but certainly I think it's safe to say, and I'll take the risk of saying this, that a 2-week military exercise, a joint military exercise involving a dozen ships, however many aircraft are going to be on those ships, all the personnel, all the weapons that are going to be used, all the fuel burn certainly is very, very easily going to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars for 2 weeks.
And, you know, people can put in their own favorite concern for where they could, for how they could use several hundred million dollars, whether it's for land preservation, land rehabilitation, you know, protecting children from being abused. I mean, we can, there, that money would go a long ways toward other things, obviously.
Yeah, and another thing that I think it's important to note for this story, I did come across a very interesting quote from the U.S. military's Alaskan Command Office, one of their PR flacks, a woman named Captain Anastasia Wassum. And I asked them for comment about why had the Navy chosen the Gulf of Alaska, given that it's critical habitat for all five of that state's wild salmon, along with all the other very, very egregious and obvious negative impacts to the marine system there. And she said that the waters where the Navy is going to be conducting these war games are quote unquote strategically significant. And that, and then she went on to quote from a recent Pacific Command study. That's the branch of the military that did this, the part that they referred to that conducted this study. And they, she said that they found that the naval training opportunities are declining everywhere in the Pacific except Alaska. And what I think is really important for people to understand, just to get the mindset of these folks, is she referred to Alaska as a, quote, true national asset. And, you know, it, this is obvious, I think, to most people, but just to kind of underscore it, that the true national asset of Alaska is in reference to how it is, how they see it as a training area, not as, you know, conserving its it naturally, biologically, and taking care of it, but simply as a training area. And I think that really sheds a lot of light on the psychology of the military and how they view the world, where everything is a resource, everything is expendable, and everything is up for grabs.
We have about 5 or 6 minutes left, and the first question I would like to ask is, can you tell people the name of the article that you wrote on this so that they can find it and just read a more extended version of what we've been talking about?
Yes, the article is titled Destroying What Remains. It's subtitled How the U.S. Navy Plans to Wargame the Arctic. And it was published, it was a joint publishing on Tom Englehart's website, tomdispatch.com, as well as truthout.org, where I work full time. And it was published fairly recently, just on May 21st. And again, it's a story about the Navy's plans to begin a 2-week wargaming exercise up over 8,000 nautical square miles in the Gulf of Alaska starting on June 15. And they have plans to use live ordnance, active and passive sonar, and their own environmental impact statement notes that they expect over the length of time that they're permitted of several years to conduct these military exercises in Alaska's waters, they admit and accept the fact that they're going to kill well over 100,000 marine mammals and other marine species during these exercises, either by direct deaths from them literally being hit by bombs, missiles, torpedoes, sonar, or by secondary impacts where these exercises would infringe upon behavior of the animals that would include breeding and surfacing and migration and things, which would also result in a death as well. And these are already permitted. They are going to take place. It doesn't look like there's anything that's going to stop it at this point. And the Navy is actively sealing up permits to conduct them for the next 5 years, these exercises, that is, and have already begun the process of securing permits to conduct exercises like this through 2030.
So, and I apologize because I'm late to this in terms of interviewing you. This interview is being done on the 10th, and it will be aired in 3 or 4 weeks, which means that this time, I'm too late to help with this time. But given that when people hear this, it will be done this year, how can they start ramping up? And this is, I'm going to ask you for A, people in Alaska, and B, people elsewhere. And you've sort of answered this already, but please hit this again. What can people do to prevent this in the future? What can they start ramping up now? Because, you know, honestly, if they just hear about it 3 days before it happens, there's not much you can do anyway. So let's start preparing for next year. What do you want people to do?
Absolutely. It's not too late. I mean, I know that there's been a lot of frustration that people feel like, well, we failed, we haven't been able to stop this, but no, this is just the beginning. These exercises are going to ramp up. They're scheduled to continue. As I just said, they're already looking through 2030 to conduct exercises like this. And people need to understand that this is happening in Alaska and around Alaska, but also off all of the coastal U.S. states. And there's a massive domestic military expansion happening everywhere. And people need to become aware of this and make others aware of it and start fighting it and start raising hell and start being as vocal about it as possible and get this information out, because it's only ramping up. We're seeing it happening. It is opening up a window where there can be some collaboration happening across multiple political lines between people resisting it. And we're starting to see it. And it does dovetail in with the battles against the pipelines and the fracking that we're seeing down in Texas now, across the Midwest, where really interesting alliances are being formed between, you know, some pretty right-wing political groups, as well as some pretty hardcore left-leaning groups of environmentalists and other activists. And this is it's an interesting window that I think we're in now, and that people can start to take advantage. But absolutely, the story is it's kind of evergreen. It's not ending. It's really just kind of beginning a new phase of this domestic military expansionism. And the sooner people get involved in this, the better.
So that would be a good place to end. But actually, I want to – can you take like 1 or 2 minutes to I think your work is just so fantastic in general. Can you give people an overview of some of your other work? Sorry to only do 1 or 2 minutes, but can you talk about, say, your books or anything else?
Sure, Derek. Thanks. I'm basically the climate disruption reporter for Truth Out, in that I do a monthly dispatch for them where I survey the planet and report a comprehensive view, the best I can, of what's happening regarding climate disruption as far as the latest scientific reports, the latest developments, like the recent collapsing of the Larsen B and Larsen C Antarctic ice shelves. Those are going to be collapsing soon. New eras starting in the Arctic and things like this. I do other environmental related stories, and, you know, focusing on methane releases that are happening across the Arctic and other thing, positive feedback loops related to climate change. Although I do also still conduct some general environmental stories. I just released a story on the dangers of oil trains, even when they don't derail and explode and turn themselves into firebombs, basically taking out entire small cities. But the dangers of the pollutants of them, even just rolling through a community without exploding, as well as still covering stories related to Iraq from time to time. So I'm covering a lot, but with definitely a specific focus continuing to stay on climate disruption and the environment in general.
So, yeah, thank you so much for all that. And I just want to say again, as I've said so many times before in public and in private, that, you know, you are one of my heroes, and I would like to thank you for being on the program. I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Dar Jamail. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.